Well, welcome everyone. Welcome to Life in the Peloton, presented by the Cycling Podcast. I'm Mitch Stocker, and I've got Lionel Burney with me again to preview and give you a little intro to our next episode with Andre Greipel. Welcome, Lionel.
Hello, Mitch. Hello, everyone. Yeah, great to be talking to you. We're on opposite sides of the world to one another at the moment, aren't we?
We are, and we have a little chuckle as good morning or good evening as I sip away on a beer, as you have a coffee, I'm assuming.
Yes, very much so. A bit early for me for a beer, Mitch. It's just gone 9 a.m. here. I don't want to get the listeners worried about me and my lifestyle choices. But yeah, I've been following your racing over the last couple of weeks. Tour Down Under first, of course, and now you're in the thick of the Herald Sun Tour as we talk. Your home race, basically, in and around Melbourne.
It's great. I really do love the Sun Tour. I've worked it out. This is my 12th time at the Herald Sun Tour, and I've had some success in the early years, and now it's just a really nice race to come back to. And like you said, race on those home roads, even be in little towns that I've maybe never been to, but I just enjoy that Aussie culture. So it's fun to be back at the old Sun Tour.
And what's the reaction to the podcast returning for a new season been, and also your collaboration with us here at the Cycling Podcast?
It's been fantastic. I'm very happy to say, like, a lot of the people I've spoken to from Life in the Peloton audience have come across and found the podcast still, which has been great. It was one of my fears that they weren't going to be able to find it, and they have been able to find it, which is great. And the first episode, I think, went off without a hitch. Jimmy himself has had some great responses out on the rides and stuff around Melbourne. So thanks for all the feedback from everyone out there. That really is great to hear, because I'm happy I can still bring you some good episodes.
Before we move on, because obviously quite a lot of people will perhaps be discovering Life in the Peloton for the first time. So just let people know how they can kind of keep in touch with what you're doing online and on social media.
Make sure you send me a message. You can either drop me a line on my Instagram, Life in the Peloton handle, or send us an email at contact@lifeinthepeloton.com. Or just go over and check out the website at www.lifeinthepeloton.com. It's all very Life in the Peloton-esque, so I'm sure you won't get it wrong there. And just send me an email. Lots of emails coming in this week. I think it's probably been my biggest week of emails, which is great. Some good story suggestions, even just some thumbs up, which has been fun too. And if you still haven't, well, you obviously would know where the podcast is if you're listening to this, so I don't probably need to explain that again.
No. Well, welcome along, everyone. And before we get on to what is an absolutely cracking second episode of 2020, one of the things when we broke cover with our collaboration and we announced that we'd be working together this year, people were very worried that the Cycling Podcast would drop your very distinctive theme music. Now, there's a little bit of a story about how we've gone about getting official permission to use the music, Mitch. But first of all, people who watched the Tour de France in the 1980s in the UK will be familiar with it because it was a theme tune of the Channel 4 nightly highlights of the Tour de France. But what does it mean to Australian cycling fans, your theme music, and what does it mean to you?
This is a really good question, because I've been asked this a lot of times and I've answered it a lot of times individually, but I'm glad I can put it out there now, is that this music to me was what made me fall in love with cycling. This is what I used to grow up with, watching the 6:30 highlights on SBS, hearing Mike Tomalaris intro the Tour de France 6:30 highlights, and then I heard Phil Liggett, Paul Sherwin commentate. So it was just, for me, the pinnacle of the Tour de France. And my brother and I came up with this idea of, let's get this music back involved, because that was what we loved about the Tour de France, about cycling, and it just fit so well. Every time I hear that music, I just think of racing. So I hope, and I'm pretty sure everyone loves that tune, and that probably gets them in the same spirit too.
Well, we had a bit of a mission to get permission to continue using the music. For those who don't know, Pete Shelley was the lead singer of the punk band The Buzzcocks, and he died in December 2018. And, well, I think a lot of people reading the obituaries when Pete Shelley died would have been surprised by the line that revealed to many that he was the man who composed the Tour de France music for Channel 4. He was commissioned by the production company TSL make that piece of music. And as you say, Mitch, it really resonates. It really transports me back to the 1980s and tea time in July, waiting for the Tour de France. And as you were coming across to our platform, we felt we should find out who owned the rights and get permission to use the music. And it sent me on quite a circuitous journey to track down, first of all, trying to contact music publishing companies to see whether it was part of the Buzzcocks back catalogue. And my journey took me to the Buzzcocks themselves. I contacted the band and they put me in touch with a man called Raph Edmonds, who was Pete Shelley's longtime manager. And we had a chat on the phone and I explained what we wanted to do. And Raph actually, in turn, asked Pete Shelley's widow, Greta, and she has given permission for us to continue using the music. So we are absolutely delighted for that. It's kind of on the condition that we keep the legacy of Pete Shelley alive. And so I'm really glad that we can sort of shed a little bit of light on how that piece of music came about. And well, it's so symbolic of the Tour de France and France itself, because the refrain at the end is very much a kind of a mimic of the French nursery rhyme Frère Jacques, isn't it? So yeah, that's the story behind the music, and well, it will be the opening to every episode of Life in the Peloton this season.
It's fantastic, and I love hearing that story too. It's such a great tune, and even me editing every episode and listening to that tune a million times more than everyone else, I still love hearing it. So it's great to hear that story, and I'm happy to keep the legacy living on.
Well, let's move on with this episode, Mitch. A really great guest, someone who here on the Cycling Podcast we famously described as a fading force, and he then went on to win more stages of the Tour de France after we'd written him off. A veteran sprinter now. I don't think he'd mind being described as a veteran. He's got a lot of experience under his belt, one of the most successful riders to come out of Germany, and a real big name to get early on in the year, Mitch.
Well, Andre, I randomly have had a really good relationship with Andre throughout the peloton, and he came up to me a couple of years ago and said, "I listened to your podcast. I'd love to get on it." And I thought, he's taking the piss. Surely he doesn't listen to my podcast. He came back to me and said it again and again, and I went, I would love to have him on the podcast. And it took me a bit of courage to get up the courage and go and ask him. And I pinned him down and he was better than I even imagined. He talks so well on this podcast. I had a great time asking him all those questions I've always wanted to know, all about the old times and just about him as a sprinter and about his lead out train, because I've admired him from afar in the peloton and just enjoyed his presence in the peloton. He's such a lovely guy. And so I just really, really enjoyed sitting down with him and having this chat.
Excellent. Well, let's get stuck in, shall we? Just let us know, whereabouts did this conversation take place?
I just pulled him aside and we were at dinner, and then we went up into, actually it was in Matt Keenan's hotel room. He was nice enough to offer his room to us, get a quiet space. We sat back up in his room, and just after one of the stages, I think it was after stage three, and had a chat. Just up in a hotel room in the Hilton in Adelaide.
Excellent. Well, let's hear your conversation with Andre Greipel.
Welcome, Andre Greipel. Welcome to Life in the Peloton.
Hello, and I'm really glad and happy as a follower also to be part of your podcast, Mitch.
You have actually been asking me for a couple of years, when are you going to get me on the podcast? And I was like, really? You do it? And I was like, I can't believe Gripes wants to come on my podcast. So I finally pinned you down and got you on here. So welcome. Great.
Yep, thanks.
2014. Tour of Luxembourg, solo victory. Very uncommon for a sprinter, in my eyes, to do that. Run us through what happened that day. Last stage of Tour of Luxembourg.
Actually, this is my only victory I could manage to get solo. So yeah, I was flying on that day somehow. I really wanted to go deep just ahead of the Tour de France and prepare also the German championships. So the last day was anyway uphill finish, so I just wanted to go on the break and wanted to go really deep. And somehow, yeah, that break stayed away, or we could manage somehow to make it stay away. And at the end, I was the only one who stayed away. I was quite strong and smart somehow as well. So I always went when it was necessary, super hard. And yeah, I can descend quite well. So nobody could manage to get me back. Yeah,
that's what I really love about you, because from the outside, I see this guy, and this is, I'm being very stereotypical here, but sprinters normally are very good at sprinting, and any other time, they don't do much else. And that's great, because they win races. But you, on the other hand, when it's not, when you're not sprinting, and when it's not a stage for you, I often see you going in the breakaway. If it's a classic, racing the classics on the front foot. If it's not that, it's a hilly day, you're riding on the front. I see you as the best teammate, because when you're sprinting, you're awesome, you're winning. But also when you're not sprinting, you're an awesome teammate. And that victory there epitomizes that. It was like, it's an uphill finish. I'm going to go on the breakaway. I'm going to try and win. Is that something that you really like doing? Do you like racing as well as just sprinting?
It's, I would say, kind of my character as a bike rider. So, of course, I'm a sprinter, so I have to wait a lot of times and have to save my bullets. But on the other side, when I can give something back, what the teammates made for you, I'm always super happy to do so and try or do 100% the best for them. So, and especially also in the classics, it's really important to ride aggressively and also with, yeah, let's say you have to be also smart and also in account of the teammates. It doesn't make sense if I wait and in the peloton, it doesn't help them. So I'm always trying to get ahead a little bit, and then I can be able to help them. But still, it's my way. I would like to be to race and cycle more often, that I can be a bit more aggressive.
Is that something you wish that you could have done more in your career, just race rather than just waiting for the sprint all the time?
Yes, I would say maybe I don't have the engine to do it every stage or every day, but
you enjoy that.
I'm really enjoying that, and it's also like building up a house somehow. You're really getting into the stage or into the day, and you somehow start to realize this could work out, and then you in your own movie somehow, and you just try to end it up in a good way.
I certainly hate it when I see you attacking and I'm thinking, oh, I get in a breakaway with you. I've been in a breakaway in the Tour of Flanders with you. I was away and then you came across. I thought, God damn it, Greipel's here. What's he doing here? You know, and you just rip it up. So do you like the fact of racing like that, because there isn't that expectation of winning and you can just race a bit freer and just see what happens? Or you just like the difference? What's the expectation of winning like for you?
When you just take the classics, I've never done any attacks for myself to be up there or finishing it off. It was always in account for the teammates, that the plan was that they're going to join me somehow and I can be able to help them somehow. Yeah, but on the other side, it's the way you have to read also a race. There are different scenarios can happen, but there are always the points where you can possibly make an attack working out or not. So when you have the experience, of course, you know it better when you should do it and when not. So I always could manage to find the good situations to stay away and get a little bit of a headshot, but it was sometimes it's not worth to put the bullet so early on the on the road, because you cannot make the final anymore then.
What was it like then, comparison to the day that you had to wait and do a sprint? Do you feel that pressure, or do you really enjoy that as well, that expectation of, okay, today's a sprint day for me and I've got the whole team working for me and they expect me to win? Do you like that expectation?
Of course, dealing with pressure is not always easy, and it wasn't. When you have a good lead-out team, for sure it helps you a lot of times, and it takes away a lot of pressure because you always can count on them. But on the other side, like, I really like to surprise myself sometimes as well, and also maybe some fans. And I mean, I'm not doing it for the fans in that moment, but on the other side, I really like to surprise myself in that moment. And then you still realize, oh, this is really enjoyable what you're doing here. And yeah, you just get fully into this race, even if you have bad legs. But the mental strength helps you a lot of times as well.
Interesting. All right. Well, then I want to go back way back to the beginning now. I want to go back to Rostock. Famous town, also famous Jan Ulrich coming from there too. This is the prodigy of cycling, I think, from the outside. I want you to tell everyone, and me, myself, what it was like growing up as a German, through the German system, as a cyclist. Was there cycling schools involved? What was your, what was it like growing up for you?
So the wall came down at 89. So actually at 1990 was the first real year where there was this change from East German to West, or to a complete Germany. So the cycling school I was, or the club I was riding for, was still doing the same East German system. The trainer was the same. So
how old were you then?
It was 1992, so I was 10 when I started. And that trainer was the same like Ulrich had, so we had the same guy who scouted us, let's say. But yeah, this East German system is still among us, to be honest.
The strength, the East German strength, I like that.
Yeah, but I mean, on the other side, it's I think I can speak for all the cyclists who are starting in a club. You are trusting a trainer in that moment, and they try to teach you cycling in the way they think it's good. So for myself, it was like, okay, that trainer told me, okay, you have to work hard in the winter, then you will have a good season. So, and it's not just riding the bike, it's athletic, it's gym, it's cyclocross.
What were you doing then as a 10 to sort of 14 year old? What sort of training were you doing back in those days?
We did everything. We were running, we were in the gym, we were doing, we did cyclocross, we did track, we did really, literally, we did everything. So, I mean, that helped me throughout my career, because you, that's the way I got to know cycling, that it can be fun in this, in the winter times. It's so much fun sometimes, where you don't need to think about the bike. You just run a little bit or climbing up a hill.
And you're meeting your mates at the club. You had friends there. And it was like, what adventure can we do today? We're going to race. We're going to run. Yeah. And you challenge each other.
I mean, we did like hunting with track bikes. So with a fixed gear around.
And in the forest.
That was not on the track. That was everywhere we could ride with these track bikes. So... Yeah, you get to know some skills, and of course the trainer didn't even know it that we did this. Maybe when there was a puncture or anything, he was thinking like, "What happened here?" But no, it was always really good fun.
Yeah, nice. Well, fast forwarding, we mentioned Jan Ulrich, and to fast forward a little bit through that period, 2006, you actually were racing with Jan Ulrich at Team Mobile, and that was quite a significant thing because just after 2006 was the whole Operation Porto, and Jan Ulrich was named on that list. And ultimately in 2007, Team Mobile stopped. And what I think was quite significant then, I had the feeling that was when it was difficult in Germany for cycling. You were just starting your career, pro career, starting to come through and show yourself. And ultimately, you've now raced through that really difficult part, and now Germany, I get the feeling, likes cycling again. Tell me a little bit about that beginning, coming on Team Mobile with, I don't know if they were people you looked up to, it was a big team, it was one of the best teams in the world at that point, Jan Ulrich, Andreas Kloden. What was that like coming on that team? Did you know them well, or were they sort of role models?
First of all, it's like this jersey when it was on TV. There was a really big, it was the biggest company you could find in Germany. So that jersey, everybody knew. So it's like Bayern Munich or Barcelona or whatever. It was just a childhood dream to ride for that team. And this dream came true in that moment. So I didn't know lots of them. I knew a few riders. But you came there in a system. And when I still look back now, this team picture, it was amazing what riders were there. So I'm quite sure that there were for sure 10 to 12 guys paid more than $1 million. So it was just this company had so much money that they could keep all these riders in the team. But on the other side, I was also quite sure that it's going to be an experience. You make something out of it or you don't.
Mm. Did you feel pressure coming in? Or were you just a young guy just trying to find your feet anyway?
Yeah, for sure. You came, I mean, you are scouted for a reason and signed up for that team for a reason. So they had a plan with me, I would say. But still, you need to find a way. And I had not so much clue about cycling in that moment yet. And I also, not like in these days, now you have the internet, you have Instagram and everything. If you want to, you can get to know everything you want. And that time, nobody told me anything. So now, in these days, you don't need a teammate who is teaching you anything. When somebody asks me, I'm always happy to talk about it and to share my experience. On the other side, now they just need to type in on Google, what I have to do on an endurance ride, how do I do the nutrition or things like that. I really had to get to know everything myself, and sometimes also in the painful way when you get dropped things like that you will never forget. But I always say, what doesn't kill you make you stronger. So
who were the guys that you looked up to there? Who were the mentors? Were there guys that I wouldn't necessarily know about that weren't the big stars, or was it always the guys that we know?
I can tell you that my first ever night I spent with a T-Mobile rider was with Stefan Wesermann.
Oh, yeah.
They put me in the room with him, and I came in the room. I was like, okay, that is a big rider, so how do you act?
Yeah.
For sure, you have so much respect for this rider. So of course, it was in the off season. All the riders went on the piste. Of course, not the neo professionals. I somehow could sneak out and sneak out from that party to not just getting killed my engine.
Yeah.
So I went in the room, and I just can remember that he came in the room at 5:30 in the morning and switched on the lights, and he said, "Hey, young guy, what are you doing?" And I just woke up. I said, "Hey, yeah, well, what am I doing in the night? I'm sleeping." "Okay, my friend, your job is tomorrow to wake me up at 8 o'clock in the morning." So then you are there, like you are neo pro.
Like in 3 hours' time, you mean?
Yeah. And he was full gas drunk. So, and I couldn't sleep then anymore, because I was thinking, okay, how do I wake him up? Yeah. What am I going to do? I woke him up, and he really acted like normal, that he didn't drink any alcohol or anything. It was a nice experience, but I have to say again, it was in the off season, so everything, when you went out for a party, it's always good. And I think it's known that a lot of active riders or athletes are quite good in partying as well.
Yeah, that's what I think I missed too, is that's the team bonding, and that I speak about it a little bit on the podcast, that I feel like it's drifting away a little bit, this earning your stripes, coming through as a neo pro and learning the way of the peloton, and then eventually earning your stripes and progressing. But it's a different peloton now, and that's something I want to discuss with you afterwards. But I do want to discuss then what it was like through that period of, say, 2007 when T-Mobile sort of stopped, and through the next few years and even the next decade, for you personally, what was that like being a German, one of the best German riders coming through, if not the best guy in the peloton at that time? Did you feel this responsibility of, I have to fly the flag, I have to try and make the German people love cycling again, or you just did it for yourself? Was that difficult even for your personal life, racing as a German, when people didn't really like German people didn't really like cycling anymore? Tour de France wasn't on TV anymore. What was that like?
In that same moment, I was just now thinking about my experience I had with the T-Mobile jersey.
Mm.
I can remember that I was passing by a beer garden where everybody is drinking beer, and one guy was shouting behind me, "Hey, you athlete or whatever, taking drugs, blah blah blah." And I just thought, okay, I'm not a cheater. I'm riding my bike every day. I train hard. I do everything I can to be a good rider. So I just turned around and I said to this guy, "Okay, my friend, I just came here from my town where I live, and this is 80 kilometers away. And I'm doing this not once a day. I'm doing this nearly every day. We can meet up here tomorrow, take all the drugs you want, and I'm gonna be faster than you."
Yeah, nice.
Everything you want. And he was, I think he couldn't even reply to me. So this was a bad experience in that moment, but I was so angry in that moment also with the generation ahead of me, because sometimes nowadays I can't understand what happened in that days.
Mm.
But on the other side, it didn't help our generation. Yeah. For sure, I could have get a better contract if these things wouldn't happen. And I also can say that in that moment, I wanted to build a house, and I asked for a credit in the bank. And I asked 100 banks, and they didn't want to lend me money. Mm. So this was always the same answer. Okay, you're a professional athlete or bike rider. You can get tested positive tomorrow, and you cannot pay back the money. Mm. So there was no bank who wanted to give us money to buy a house. So this affected everything what happened there. This affected not just the cycling, also the normal life.
Did you see that transition over the years? As you started to become successful and you started to win, did you notice the people starting to change? Did you think it was necessarily yourself? Was it a group, maybe even like, you know, Gerald Schierlich was there also winning, and like you guys together? Or was it, it took a long time for the public to change their mind? And what was that point?
When that moment when T-Mobile shut down, there was already the thought in that moment of the team manager to make a change to a younger generation. And in that moment, I never thought about being a top sprinter or anything. Mm. Because like you said before, the times are gone that you have to get to know professional cycling in the way of a neopro. First, you're going to get bottles. Then you're going to have to pull in the front. Then you may have to make a lead out or things like that. This is the way I got to know cycling. So I knew exactly what I have to do in that moment. Maybe this also helped me to understand my teammates better, because I know what they have to do, what sacrifices, how professional they have to be, things like that. But like I said before, in that time there was a change to get cycling into a younger generation, especially also to get some more German talents in. And I'm quite sure that all of these riders had so much talent to turn around in that moment. For sure, there was also a lot of trust from the team management in that time. And somehow there was the whole change in cycling, that everybody was riding more clean than it was before. And you can see this also now, that all these younger riders who are really talented, they come up getting professional and already can be successful. So that is always a good sign that there's a big, there was a big change and is a big change that that's somehow a clean sport. For sure, you always have some black sheeps, we say in Germany, but still, it's always a good sign to see young riders being successful.
And I see that, like I've been saying all along, I see you as the pioneer of that. And these guys were able to follow behind you, you know, like John Degenkolb, Marcel. These guys, I think, were able to flourish because you were there breaking the way again. I could be wrong, but I get the feeling that 2008 out in Australia in Tour Down Under, that was the sort of the start of Gorilla Greipel. The big results started coming. You won the overall here, and that same year you won your first Grand Tour stage at the Giro. Was that a turning point for you, 2008, or you sort of felt things coming already before that? And what was the difference?
2007, I had to pull already a lot of sprints for Giolec. We were quite successful. I could win also some races myself. But yeah, Down Under was the first time also a Pro Tour race in that time. And somehow the team management asked me to be in good shape, to be able to sprint on my own there.
What did you think? We're like, oh.
I was like, okay, that's a surprise for sure.
Were you ready for it?
I did. I had no clue.
Yeah, okay.
So I just worked hard. I had also my new trainer in that time with Sebastian Weber. He kind of gave me some new points to train on. And somehow it turned out really good. Together with Alan Piper, he gave me a lot of confidence for doing this race ahead. We did also some really nice training rides, and I mean, Australia is a nice way, especially Adelaide, to start up the season. So
did you come here early?
Yeah, Alan always liked to come earlier here. So we started, this criterium, and I was so excited. I even contested in these intermediate sprints, and then I could win the overall sprint as well on that criterium. And for me, this was already like, oh. That was fun,
yeah,
and I had the whole team around me, so it was super nice experience. And somehow it turned the. That was a turning point in my career that I somehow could realize on my own that I'm able to contest on the highest level.
Because then, the next year, 2009, was another step up. You had four stage wins in the Vuelta, and you had 20 wins that season, and the only other person who had more wins than you that season was Cavendish, who was actually your teammate. What was that like, having practically at that moment the two best sprinters in the world? Was there a bit of tension there, or did you still feel like you were just finding your way as a sprinter and he was still the top sprinter in the team?
It was more like we just saw each other in the training camp in December. And we always called us A and B team, so we never raced together. So I had my teammates around me to support me for the sprint, and he had as well. For sure, we were quite successful, and still, I always say, whatever, if I would have been a spot director in that moment, I also couldn't make the choice. On the other side, they made their choices for a reason, and I think, yeah, I mean, how many stage wins in the Tour? He has 31, 32. So they made the right choice. I was kind of successful on my own way together with my B team.
Yeah.
And I still would say whatever would happen, I would make it always in the same way I did it.
What's your relationship like with Cav back then and now?
there were some conflicts, but I would say that the media made it always bigger than it really was.
Of course, yeah.
I think we both have a lot of respect for each other.
Yeah.
But on the other side, it's like we are colleagues. And in that moment when we were teammates, we both have the same character as a bike rider. So we both wanted to...
Be the best.
Be the best. And, but I still, I think... I'm not as stubborn as he is. I see it more as a grown up than he did in that time. For sure, for me, it didn't matter in that moment against who I won. For me, it was already a childhood dream to be in the Tour de France.
Yeah.
So, and especially when I look back, my start of the tour wasn't great. I crashed kilometer minus -5 before the tour even started.
In the neutral zone
I was on the doctor's car, but this turned around by Philippe Gilbert winning the first stage in the Tour de France, and we made an incredible lead out in that day with an uphill finish.
You involved in the lead out?
Yeah, everybody was involved. Wow. So we really pushed everyone on the limits, and Gilbert finished it off. And I remember finishing my first Grand Tour stage, or first Tour stage, with goosebumps everywhere. It was a really nice experience. And the other sprint stages, we were always close. I was second, I was third. And on that day, everything came together. I was in a perfect position behind Kev, and I could pass him. And for sure, it made me somehow proud to win against him, or I'm still proud. But on the other side, it was just
to win that
stage. To win that day, and also somehow prove myself that I can win Tour de France stages was something what helped me throughout my career.
Well, describe to me, you alluded to it a little bit there, but tell the people out there, and even tell me, how important... One, a lead-out train is for a sprinter, but how important, I think, even more so to your style of sprinting, a lead-out train is to you. Because some sprinters, they don't like it fast and lined out. They just sort of, it's too hard for them. They like to come from the bunch. But the feeling I get is, once you have your lead-out train making the speed, no matter how fast it is, you've still got enough power to step off that train. Tell everyone what it's like and what you did to create that lead out train for you. At Lotto.
Yeah, exactly. In that moment, we had 8-9 guys riding the Tour de France with ambitions, but I had just 3 guys helping me, or 2 guys helping me for the sprint. This was Seeberg and Jürgen Roland in that day. And then we were competing against a lead-out train from HTC in that time. And they were that strong that, yeah, it was impossible to beat them. They had so much horsepower that you can somehow just use your 2 guys to get somehow a good position for ahead of the sprint. So that is what we were trying in that moment. But then I knew, okay, we have to think different. We have to get stronger. And this is what we started to create then, to really trust ourselves to really line it up as hard as we can. And for that, you needed the big engines. So we had to get to bigger engines in the team with Lars Bak. Adam Hansen didn't ride the Tour in 11. He wasn't selected, but... We somehow started to create something really, really good and really fast, and it was for a lot of other teams quite hard to beat us. And if you line it up, you don't need to fight for position, and everybody was able to win their own Tour de France stages in that moment from my team, but they were totally dedicated to line it up for me. And that is what I always said also, that I like to win. But I like to win more if the whole team was into it, and if the whole team lined it up and everybody did his part. It was always something special, and this motivated me even more to finish it off.
I especially know that feeling, and I've often been the guy in front of the sprinter, the last man they call it, or even involved in the train. And people always ask me back in Australia, yeah, but you're so close, Mitch. Why don't you just go for the sprint yourself? And I said, for instance, if I was leading you out, if Andre steps off my wheel and he wins that sprint, I know he couldn't have done it without me taking him that 1 meter further. And I feel just as much victory as the sprinter raising his hands as I would. And it was difficult for people to understand that, but that team connection, it's almost better than an individual win. Just say you go in a breakaway and you win it on your own. When you've had everyone, like you said, hitting their markers, swinging out, just that, I almost get goosebumps for it myself. It's a crazy feeling.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I always try to tell young riders as well, that whatever you did in the under 23, it's deleted. Because this is not professional cycling. You have to earn your spot. You have to get to know what you are good at or what you don't. So there are a lot of young guys, they think, okay, I was a climber under 23, so I might be a climber here in the professional race. But to be honest, there are maybe 5 to 10 climbers who are able to win races. And cycling gets that much more scientific now, that everybody is training on top level. So when you're good at leading out, yeah, go for it. But get a good lead out man, and then you will have a long career in front of you. And that's the same for being like a helper for a climber uphill. If you are good at it, you can have a really long career and be successful as well, and at the end you get a good contract.
Well, speaking of long careers, Adid, you've touched on it now, you've had a long career, and a lot has happened, Simon, from those days that I talked about back in the Team Mobile days. And I actually watched the other night the 2000 Olympics replay on TV. When I was doing a bit of research from you, I was looking up some stuff about Jan Ullrich, and I was watching the 2000 Olympics, and it was just amazing to watch how different cycling was from back then. Then when I came into cycling sort of in 2008, compared to the day that it is now. And you've been there throughout all those periods. What do you see as some of the most significant changes? Whether that might be the way we race, whether that's something significant with you, what has been those changes over the years you can point out?
I would say it's the input from the media made cycling change a lot, because now we have a full live broadcast from a lot of races. So it's not like in the old days, everybody knew, okay, that race will be live from 2 o'clock, 2 p.m. And then you had one guy in the bunch, he said, okay, why you want to attack now? For what? There's no live TV, so just cruise around. And then that is what, because I'm rooming with the son of Rick Zabel, and he always comes up with stories from the past and how much this changed, because my father told me different. But in that time it was like this. There was Cipollini saying, okay, we do the first 80 kilometers tranquilo, and then the race is starting. So he gives a wave with a hand and the race is on. So 3-4 guys attacked, break away, and for a reason, and that in that time the live TV started.
Yeah.
And now there are a lot of races live from kilometer zero, so there's a lot of advertisement for the sponsors, and that makes the races much more fast than they were in the past. Plus, that for me, this is one big change what made cycling so different now. And also, of course, the scientific and thing with the internet. Everything is available now online. And if you're not if you are smart, you always will find your way in figuring out what is good for you and what not. So you don't need to have somebody telling you what is good and what not.
And even some programs to tell you if you're tired or if you're not. You know, I think we read into that too much. And even though I'm not from as old as you, I'm still somewhat between there. And I'm starting to get morphed into this new way, because you have to, you know, to you have to try and keep up with the game, because ultimately that's what it is.
Yeah, but on the other side, I'm always open-minded for a new way of training, right?
Mm.
But then on that same moment, I'm thinking like, okay, in the past I have done it this way, and it seems like that it wasn't so bad. So for me, it's sometimes difficult really to adapt for this new way of training, because I'm still think that I wasn't so bad when I did before. It different in this old German system. And then I sometimes also, or a lot of times, I come back to this long endurance ride without a computer on top who tells you what you are doing, just enjoy the ride. Cleaning your mind as well, that helps me a lot of times. Even maybe training wise and scientifically, it's not the best ride you can do, but if it helps you to clean your mind or clear your mind, it's something what is quite good at it.
Yeah, I think so too. All right, last question. This is a little one. When you're out training now, are you a coffee stop guy or are you not?
I'm a coffee stop guy.
Okay. Every ride?
Not every ride. If I'm really into a lot of intervals, etc., then I just like to get rid of it. And
get home.
And get home, or maybe I do a coffee break then just before I'm home or something. But for me, a good training day is always connected to a good coffee.
Yeah, nice. Thanks, mate. Glad to have you on the pod finally.
Thanks a lot, eh?
Cheers. Well, that was the Andre Greipel interview, and I hope you enjoyed that, everyone, because I certainly enjoyed sitting back there with him and getting to ask him all those questions and actually hearing him speak so honestly about everything I asked him. And I wasn't too sure about how he was going to go with all that and what sort of answer I was going to get, but it was fantastic. That's the way I felt anyway. What do you think there, Lionel?
Well, I thought it was absolutely fascinating to hear from someone who, from our point of view in the media, has felt sometimes like a quite a difficult person to get to know, in the sense that he's somebody who, around the team buses, is usually very focused on his racing. Sometimes when I've approached him to ask for a quick word after a race, it's been a flat no, which, you know, that you take the rough with the smooth when doing our job in the media. He's always been very polite and kind of open in press conference scenarios, but not somebody that I would say that I really had a sense of who he was or what motivated him. And over the last 40 minutes or so, listening to him talk to you, Mitch, I feel like I know a bit more who the real Andre Greipel is. And I've got to say, you know, he came across as a really likeable and very honest person.
He's fantastic. And I think one thing I loved about him was that question that I didn't even go there, but he brought it up, what's happened and what's changed in the peloton over those years. And I love the way that he came through the peloton, that earning your stripes and understanding the levels of where you need to be in the peloton. I was really happy that he brought that up. And I just love hearing about those old times, about how tough it was. And you just really had to do every job as you came through the peloton before you could be a real winner. So I think that's something that's faded away from the peloton, but I certainly like hearing about it.
The couple of things that leapt out to me, Mitch, were the story about his, I think, first training camp with T-Mobile, a room sharing with Stefan Weissmann, who was obviously one of the experienced guys on the team. And as a young guy, his job is to wake Weissmann up for training after he'd been out for a big night. Now, we're always told that those days are gone as well. But clearly there's the occasional night on a training camp or two that goes on. I suppose we are talking about 12, 13, 14 years ago now.
It must be, yeah. I think those days are gone. Like, I don't hear about that anymore. So it is great to hear about a guy that's sort of a big star now. You can't imagine him being told you know, to wake someone else up. But I guess, you know, it happened once upon a time.
And the other thing, from the point of view of having covered Mark Cavendish's career from the start, was I remember the years when Greipel and Cavendish were teammates, and they really were, you know, there was a lot of rivalry within that team for the number one status as sprinter. And Cavendish kind of won that battle, didn't he? I do know, I think we've talked about this on our podcast, you know, Cavendish really didn't want Greipel to be in any of the races he was doing for a period when they were at HTC Columbia, just because he didn't want any confusion. He wanted to be the man that everyone was working for. And I found it interesting, you know, Greipel there was kind of humble enough to describe his team as being the B team, but then he went out and he bagged a load of wins himself and got himself an opportunity to prove that he could be, on his day, the undisputed fastest man in the peloton, as his Tour de France stage wins tell us. But what a start to the Tour de France career for him, crashing in the neutral zone and then ending up with the stage win and yellow jersey for Philippe Gilbert. That's another day I remember well from 2011, and a story that really probably would have passed us by, because everyone in the media would have been focusing on Philippe Gilbert winning. So it was nice to hear that one as well.
It's great, yeah. I love hearing that, and different things that stick out to these guys in their career and stuff you can't find on their result page and whatever. And that's what I loved about bringing up the Luxembourg stage. I thought when I read that, I knew that was going to be a story. So it's great to talk to these guys and find out their stories, that really what means to them the most throughout their careers.
Yeah, I'm learning as I listen, Mitch, because that was a really unconventional way to start. Talking to Andre Greipel about the one race win that didn't come in a bunch sprint finish, and that really had me hooked right from the start of your chat. So yeah, keep it up, keep going. We've got another one coming in a couple of weeks. Are we gonna spoiler who that is, or let the listeners discover in a couple of weeks' time?
No, we're gonna let the listeners discover in a couple of weeks' time. We've got a couple in the recording room ready to go, but I'm still deciding which one's going to go ahead, and still want to make one more last recording here at the Sun Tour. So that last recording might jump in front of that too. But I also want to remind everyone, if they haven't had the chance, to go down and visit at Life in the Peloton, the Etsy store there, and make sure you get yourself some merchandise. You can't go listening to Life in the Peloton without drinking out of the Life in the Peloton mug or having a t-shirt on, because it just doesn't make sense to listen to the podcast without being completely decked out in the merch. That's the way I see it anyway.
Well, you were very kind to give me a Life in the Peloton t-shirt, Mitch, when I visited you in Girona before Christmas. Still pretty chilly here, so I've not actually managed to go outdoors in it, but I'm wearing it around the house. And when I listen to your episodes come into our Dropbox, I make sure I get the Life in the Peloton t-shirt on.
It only makes sense. I know that, that's for sure. Until next time, guys. Tune in, and I hope you enjoy the last few episodes. And if you haven't heard them, go back and listen again. And until the next episode, I'm Mitch Stocker.
I'm Lionel Burney. Thanks for listening.
You have been listening to Life in the Peloton. The producer of this episode was Will Jones. The music in this episode was composed by Pete Shelley. Thanks, mate.